Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's rapidly changing world. Your host is Dane Gruneveld, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience enhancing team dynamics and innovation. Today, Dane is joined by Bex Port. Bex is an accomplished human resources leader experienced in working with executives to build and deliver transformative people strategies. Currently, Bex is the Chief People Officer at 10X Genomics, where she has helped scale the culture and build a high-performance organization. Tune in to discover the following key insights. First, how an honest and intentional culture enables employees to thrive. Being transparent about organizational culture helps employees align with environments where they can truly thrive. Second, the value of continuous performance management. Regular ongoing feedback ensures alignment and growth, avoiding the pitfalls of delayed performance reviews. Finally, AI's transformative impact on teams and individuals. AI tools are reshaping how teams operate, enhancing coaching, feedback, and decision-making, while prompting new ways to define human contribution. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team or put on your headphones, and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name is Dane Gruneveld, CEO of the Huddle 3 Group. And today I'm joined by Bex Port. Bex is a CHRO, a speaker, a connector, a fellow British citizen like me, I believe, and also an American citizen now. So welcome to the show, Bex.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's good catching up before the show. I think there's a lot of really cool things that we can dive into, and you've got a great story, work for some great companies. Maybe for the benefit of our listeners, you can give us a little bit of a backstory on how you come to be doing the great work that you do.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm originally from a fabulous place in the UK called Hull. So big shout out to anybody who's listening in Hull today. And I, early on in my career, discovered psychology. So I did a degree, master's, PhD in psychology. And it became a lifelong passion of just interested in people and what makes us tick and how we can be better. And I then took a path into HR. I worked in consulting, and then I worked in banking. I discovered after almost a decade in banking that nobody really wanted to work for a bank anymore, and everybody wanted to work for a tech company. And so I left banking and joined Netflix, and from Netflix joined where I am now, which is a life science company called 10X Genomics, where I'm the Chief People Officer. But throughout my career, I've always been focused on how do we create employee-centric workplaces? How do we create environments where people can thrive and do the best work of their lives?
I love that. When you think about people thriving, there's a lot of challenge out there from certain sort of elements of society and leadership right now that maybe we've overdone the accommodating employee movement. So how does that kind of bounce off your position on thriving? Like, what is employee thriving to you?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I mean, I want employees to thrive so that we can run great businesses. So everything we do is obviously in service of making an organization more successful. And so, you know, an employee thriving is really dependent upon your culture. And I think the culture you're trying to create will define what employee thriving looks like. And so in some companies, you know, it is talking about lots of social issues all of the time. In other companies, it's not, because that's not what they want to focus on in terms of their culture. I don't think there's a right or a wrong across that spectrum.
Yeah.
It's what do you... what kind of environment do you want to create? And for an employee to thrive, you've got to be really honest about that environment, because I might really, really want to talk about social issues. And if my employer is saying, we don't do that here, and I didn't realize that before signing up, then I'm not going to thrive, because it's a need I've got that's not been met. And so I think it's really important that employers are like, hey, this is us, right? And you know, people can self-select in or out. And employers need to spend a lot of time thinking about who they are and what kind of employer they want to be, because we're all individuals and we've all got different needs.
I think that's brilliant. It's interesting. I've had a number of people over the years talk to me about sort of Sinek's version of starting with the why, and then, you know, perhaps starting more from the place of who, or even now I'm hearing more about starting from how, because how is actually the way that people show up and do work. So it's really interesting seeing those different perspectives and how they take shape. Yeah. If you think about those cultures, as you said, that are really honest about who they are and how they work and how they have conversations, what have you tended to see or identify over time that you know, determines a leadership team that's taking that seriously and being very intentional in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, I think people, I've been really fortunate, and I've worked with leaders that do take culture really seriously and understand the implications of that. I often think in, you know, positions, you know, in HR or running people teams, it can often be like, oh, well, that's the people team's job. And I think we need to be, you know, we need to be really careful to say we can help facilitate this conversation, but we all own this culture. And, you know, I think leaders are more successful if they're aware of the impact of the culture. And sometimes that's not sort of a philanthropic stance. It's a better culture leads to better engagement, leads to better productivity, leads to, you know, better outputs, right? It's sort of, again, grounded in successful businesses tend to have really strong cultures.
Yes, yeah. And interestingly, with your time at Netflix, they've always been renowned for having really built the culture deck and to have been very intentional about that. Maybe you could share a little bit about what you saw there.
Yeah, and again, that was owned by the leaders. You know, I think Reed probably wrote that culture deck, and you know, every leader in the organization believed in that culture, understood that culture, and was ready to be a custodian of that culture. And that's how strong cultures are built. You know, culture is what people do when no one's watching. It's not words on a wall. It's not catchy phrases. It's not a mouse mat. It's the way people behave, especially when nobody's telling them to behave like that.
Yeah. And do you sense in that framework how they behave when no one's watching them? Is it how do they behave in the context of the work that they're doing, or how they're behaving just as a corporate citizen, both?
I mean, I think it's probably both. I think if you go back to the notion of somebody thriving, it's hard to operate in an environment that isn't authentically one that you would want to operate in. So, you know, if I come to work and there are, you know, the no rules rules, and there's no rules, but I actually live my life in a very rule bound, rigid way, then there's probably two versions of me, and I'm paying a tax somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And I'm probably feel more natural in one of those environments. You know, I would always say, and people that I mentor and coach say, you know, find the environment you thrive in, because there's a tax you're going to pay if you're in an environment that isn't necessarily, you know, one that is your natural kind of habitat. So I would hope that people can find that. I think not everyone's always that fortunate to find, you know, a culture where I really feel like I belong. But, you know, there's a whole science of belonging that, you know, people thrive when they feel like they belong.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I had a number of conversations with a good friend and former podcast guest, Andre Martin, who talks a lot about the how. And particularly about that energy. You use the word tax, which I really like, because if you're in that environment and you don't feel like that's the way you work, or you feel confused about how people are really working and what the real rules are, it's just a constant like burden.
100%, yeah. And there's like Csikszentmihalyi is a famous psychologist that talks about flow and like being in flow where, you know, everything feels great. And, you know, the way I kind of describe it is if you like downhill skiing, if you can ski, you get into that like, oh, this is great. Yes, I'm making an effort and I have to think about my turns, but I'm in flow and thriving and loving it. And I think you can get to that point in your job. But if you're constantly thinking, I got to be careful of what I say or how I say it or how I'm perceived or what people are thinking about me, that is just, that is an energy sucker that you could be using that energy somewhere else.
Yeah, it is. It is. I'm going to play on your ski analogy here, Bex, because I love to ski. And I'm going to challenge belonging in a vacuum here too. I love to ski and powder days are my favorite days. Right? Particularly when I get to go out on the first lift. However, when I take my 12-year-old, 10-year-old and 6-year-old out in the powder, it is the worst day of my life. And I love them and I belong on the mountain with them, but it's the worst day because I'm constantly digging them out and it's just hard. So, you know, going to flow, like you can be in with a team of people that you really think are your people. You love and respect them. You work in a particular industry. You've got skills. But that flow of like how the work gets done and how you each show up in the moment of doing the work together, it's tricky. It almost suggests that belonging isn't enough. I don't know what you think there.
Yeah, I mean, it depends what you're optimizing for, right? Mm. So when you're on the mountain by yourself or with other adults who are equally as good skier, you're optimizing for going as fast as you can through the powder and having the best time of your life.
Yeah.
If you're on the mountain with a 3-year-old, an 8-year-old, or a 10-year-old and a 12-year-old, you are optimizing for time together and teaching them that, hey, one day we'll all ski through powder together and it can be really great, but right now it feels really painful. But actually, I'm role modeling to you. How do you manage through a difficult situation? And I'm not losing my mind and I'm not getting cross at you and I'm digging you out of the snow. And so again, it's, you know, but if the goal of getting up the lift was we go as fast as we can and we, you know, I get that feeling of you know, deep pow, then no, that's not going to achieve. And so I think bringing the team together before you get on the lift and saying, yeah, what's the goal? Are we all aligned? And is that possible? And what can we do with what we've got?
I love that. You've just given me some parenting advice and hopefully you've improved my skiing experience in January.
I promise I've never shouted on a ski slope before.
It's cool the way that you frame there, Bex. What are you optimizing for? Because that's not always clear. You go into some teams and, you know, a team might think that they're optimizing for cost reduction, but actually the boss wants them to give a really good customer experience and it's just not clear. How do you tend to see that show up in teams?
Yeah, 100%. And I think that is often the main problem where conflicts come from, right? Go back to the ski analogy, right? If you've not had the conversation at the bottom before you get on the lift, what are we optimizing for today? You're going to be really annoyed because you turned up wanting that deep powder experience. And the 6-year-old's like, I don't even know what deep powder is, but this is really hard work and my legs hurt, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, everybody, or as opposed to saying like, hey, this is going to be really hard work, but I promise you this is about learning and this is what you're going to learn from it. That's very different. And you feel different and they feel different. And so finding ways to constantly be aligned and, you know, things are not stable. And so we can be aligned at the top of the mountain and then, you know, there's a curveball and there's something on the mountain. We have to get aligned again. And so I think that problems I see in teams or in any relationships at work are normally about we are misaligned. And
yeah.
You know, I frequently say, and if there's an issue or a problem, what context have I not set? It's normally because I've not set enough context about why we're here and how we're going to go about this. Or, you know, and as a leader, I take that on me. That is me for not setting enough context.
Yeah. Context is a huge word. Actually, it doesn't come up a lot in the conversations that I have on this show, but it's coming up right now a lot for me as we're going into like end of year appraisal season with some of our teams, because you realize that you're getting into conversations and you're saying this didn't quite go well this year and it's now November. But you never set the context right in February or March, nor did you address it going to your mid-mountain point that it wasn't quite on track in June or July either.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we switched to continuous performance management. So we don't have an end of year performance appraisal for exactly that reason.
Yeah.
Because, you know, why would I wait? If I need to tell you to slow down on the mountain, I'm not going to wait until we get to the bottom, or else something disastrous might happen. I'm going to say, hey, let's slow up. Let's talk about it right now, because this is a problem right now. And so we, I feel that continuous performance management is really important. Now, we do have forcing functions of biannual conversations. So twice a year, there's, you know, a forcing function for managers to go deeper and to talk about development and career aspirations and those sorts of things. Because I think otherwise we all get really busy in our day jobs and that stuff never happens. And so it's all giving people a license to do it.
I like that.
But yeah, I think waiting till the end of the year is, and not setting context throughout the year is not helpful.
It's not. How do you, you know, for any of our listeners out there that have either toyed with or thought about moving to this continuous performance management approach, how do you appropriately set expectations and structure for those kind of micro conversations or moments to happen?
Yeah. I'd go back to the concept of it depends what culture you operate in, right? Mm. There are some cultures where continuous performance management just wouldn't work because people want more structure, enjoy more structure. If you took that structure away, it wouldn't happen. I think you do have to lean into much more of manager training, much more manager encouragement. You know, we have a manager digest that I send out once a month is, hey, if you're a people manager, here are some things to be thinking about. Here is a podcast about giving great feedback, or here is a paper to read, or, you know, these sorts of things to kind of encourage people to constantly think about this.
Yes.
But it's a journey. I mean, it's still, people don't love giving each other feedback. It can be really tricky and really hard, and getting it right. And people are not always open to feedback.
Yes.
And so getting it right is really, really difficult. And, you know, we're talking about teams. When you've got a really great team dynamic, you're like, oh, do I really want to share this with that person? It might upset them. And we get along so well. And, oh, I'm just not going to bother with that. I'm just going to carry on.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I think what I'm hearing there, Bex, is that with your manager digest, that you're kind of partnering learning with continuous feedback, that there needs to be some prompting and reinforcement.
Nudges. Yeah, nudges to get people to kind of remember to do that. And then I do think that these forcing functions twice a year and where employees are expecting it as well, because there's also this sort of giving people permission, like, hey, you're my manager and I'm expecting to have a conversation about this, opens up that door.
Yeah. Well, one of my mentors that I'm working with right now, he's been encouraging me down the path of having the mid-year review cycle as, this is only about how you do the work. It has nothing to do with your outputs. So we're not going to say, well, you were supposed to have shipped this product and you didn't. We're going to say, well, how did you do the work and how did you interact with your colleague in that department? But it's all how stuff. And then you get to the end of the year and now you're talking about metrics and the value created in the role. How does that land with you? Is that a good approach, confusing approach?
I guess, again, it depends on, are the two distinct, right? Or are the two so interrelated that it's hard to separate them, right?
Yeah.
You know, I work in an organization where output absolutely matters and it matters all the time, but we don't tolerate brilliant, you know, jerks or whatever sort of name you want to put. And so if somebody was having great output, but not doing the how was wrong, it would be really problematic.
Yeah.
But to have that conversation like at the end of the year and be like, hey, you've done all of this, it would be a really positive conversation, but it's actually only half the story because the conversation isn't really positive. It's you've done this, but you've caused a whole series of problems because of the way you interact with people and how you go about doing your work.
Yeah.
And so, but if you're in an organization where those two things are easier to kind of separate and it's easier to separate the how and the what, then I think you could differentiate the time, the conversation.
Yeah, that's good advice. So it's going to even differ, not only culturally, but by department. You know, you might have a very different approach in the finance team than you will in the sales team, than you will in the development team.
Yeah.
Okay, that's very cool. So you used the word nudges there around your manager digest. And I know before the show, we were talking about what could really be exciting about where teams are going, and you dived into AI. So maybe we head in that direction, you know, views and hopes for AI and team effectiveness.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think what I find so exciting about AI is just the speed and the pace of which AI is changing and impacting. You know, I remember back in about the year 2000, and I remember being like, oh, online shopping, this is a new thing. And I remember saying to someone, are you going to do your holiday shopping online? And they were like, oh, no, I don't know if it's safe. And then I was like, oh, maybe it's a next year thing, right? But it probably wasn't until, I don't know, 2010, until everybody was really doing all of their shopping online, or even afterwards, right? Like, yeah. I don't know if like Amazon was even a thing then. I'm trying to think where I was at 2010.
It still isn't in Australia.
Yeah, right? And so the pace of change was actually being very slow, right? Nearly 25 years on, people still, you know, Oxford Street in London is still packed on Christmas Eve, right? Mm. And whereas AI, you know, I went to a conference 6 months ago and people didn't really have use cases in HR how they were using AI. They were like, it's going to affect loads of change. And I was like, can somebody give me an example of where they're using it? And they're not. Today, you know, there are AI hiring tools. There are one I'm really excited about is, you know, interactive coaching tools, role-playing tools where managers can interact real-time with a voice that can tell them, hey, you know, I've got to role-play this difficult conversation with you. And so in a very short space of time, tools are already on the market. You know, a lot of HRIS systems are going to have much better chatbots that are aided by AI. And so I'm really excited by the pace of change, which I think is going to ultimately help all employees be more effective and therefore teams be more effective. And, you know, if I can role model and practice that feedback conversation that I don't really want to have with you because I don't want to upset our friendship, I do it in a really effective way because I've practiced it a few times with an AI tool, then our relationship, it lives intact. I give you good feedback. So whatever it was that I wanted you to do differently, you start to do differently, and our team becomes much more effective. So I'm super excited. And that's just in the last 6 months, right? And so 6 months from now, there will be things that, you know, I have no line of sight to today that will be on the market that will be impacting how we work. Mm. And I think it's going to be super exciting.
It is exciting. A little bit scary too.
It is a little bit scary. Although, you know, I think, I also think it will help us understand what is uniquely human.
And yeah. Oh, I like that.
Really excited about that. Because I don't know if I know what that is right now.
No, me neither. And we do know that with the disengagement and the energy that we talk to later, that we're overdoing work and work isn't actually healthy for people in its current state in a sustainable setting. So, you know, driving towards healthier outcomes, better community outcomes is really encouraging.
I completely agree. And look, work isn't working. And, you know, I think every new generation, people are like, oh, this generation doesn't want to work, or they don't want to do this. And they, you know, and every generation before them has also challenged the modern convention. You know, I didn't want to work the same way my parents wanted to work, and so on, right? And so I think changing the way that work is done is needed. And everybody has always asked for it. I just don't know that we've always been able to deliver on it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I always have these conversations with my dad. He was a publicly traded C-suite executive, but in the 90s and early 2000s where the iPhone didn't exist. So it was still a period where, you know, if it was really urgent, someone would call him, but otherwise he would get to work and read printed memos and letters and go to meetings. But it wasn't this kind of always on culture that, you know, we're now living through.
Yeah.
It's very different. Also, going back to that same mentor and friend of mine that I'm doing the work with right now, there's something that you mentioned about AI, which is really interesting, particularly around the speed, which is that it can be kind of there. It can be coaching us or assessing or role-playing with us. And the way Ian explains work is his definition of work is turning intention into reality, which I find just so like crisp and cool. And so then he'll break down intention and reality, and he'll be like, intention is our HR policy or our business strategy. It's where we're trying to go. It's what we say we stand for. And then reality is what actually shows up in our systems of work. So you've got to think that AI is going to start looking at our systems of work, whether it's hiring, whether it's performance management, whether it's productive metrics, and saying, hey, Bex, I know you said that we stand for this or our strategy is to do this, but it's not actually happening. And maybe it'll go a step further and say it's not happening, and maybe here is where you could have a look, this department or this activity.
Yeah. I mean, I totally, you know, or the culture that you want to create. So you say you want this culture, but actually here are a number of systems or policies that fly in the face of that. And here's how I'd word it differently if you really wanted it to be employee focused or employee centric or whatever it is that you're trying to drive. And I think the great thing about AI is just all of that sort of cross-functional knowledge that would have taken, you know, an individual or a group of individuals thousands of years to read,
yes,
can now be just done in 1 second. You know, I even think about, you know, our business and understanding different cures for different diseases and being able to cross-pollinate that knowledge, where people tend to get very siloed and become experts in this particular domain.
Yes.
Now you can feed all of that to AI and it can say, well, hang on a minute, you've got stuff going on over here and over there that is the same. And you two people or two disciplines have never talked to each other.
That is exciting. And I read a study, and I'm no academic, so I'm never good at actually citing or referencing, but the study was saying that often innovation comes from people in adjacent areas. You know, you don't go to the sports scientist for a sports science innovation. It might actually be another form of science that actually spots that commonality or that pattern that could apply here.
Yeah.
So just imagine all of the unknown potential and capability in an organization or across organizations in that setting.
Yeah, I completely agree.
That's cool. That's very cool. And you touched on there when we were talking about intention into reality, culture. I hadn't thought about it. I was thinking more about how the work gets done rather than the broader setting of culture. And we touched on, you know, the iPhone. But if you're a company that really stands for work-life balance or supporting part-time professionals, you know, whether they're late career or they're caring for children or whatever else it might be, and you continually kind of require them to be logging in out of hours and sending emails all around the clock, that can sometimes go hidden. But I would imagine that this would in the future become far more known.
Yeah, I mean, you just have more access. You'd hope that you would have more access to data.
Yeah.
So you could say, and you know, and that might be because, hey, we're noticing that your part-time employees seem to kind of work, you know, X hours or are logged on for 30 hours a week, not 20 hours a week as intended. Or it might be, hey, we can look through this system and see the marketing department all work after hours. And that may not be an issue because it might be that the marketing department don't come in until midday and work into the evening because that's how that team has decided is working.
Sure.
Or it might be that that's a real issue and they're logging on at 9 and not logging off until 9, right? And that's a problem. And so, again, I think AI is going to allow us to say, what do we want to optimize for and where can we get data? One of the challenges I think we often face as people professionals is what's noise and what's really an issue, right? Like, is this one or two really vocal employees that are talking about a problem, or is this really a problem? And what is the data that I can really get? And how much are people really telling me? Versus, you know, I've got a hunch. We often, you know, I like to think of our spidey senses as HR practitioners. You know, I've got a hunch that there's something going on, but I'm not, you know, nobody's telling me anything. So where can I actually get all these sources of data and be sure this is actually an issue and this is a problem I want to solve for?
Yeah, that is interesting. I've been fortunate most of my career working in and around teams of, you know, 50 to 100 people, where you can kind of operate by sticking your thumb in the air and kind of getting a sense for which direction the wind's blowing or who's having trouble with who. But once you start going into the thousands or tens of thousands or people in different countries, that must be really hard separating noise from real issues.
Yeah.
What could the dark side or the threat of this kind of accelerating shift to AI be for a HR or people leader? What should people be keeping an eye on?
You know, I don't know if I know, right? Like, I don't know. Originally, when, you know, when I first used ChatGPT, I remember thinking, oh gosh, nobody's going to learn to use judgment and think and articulate, because I'm not going to have to write an essay. And really, writing an essay isn't the subject matter of the essay. It's about evaluating the arguments and analyzing and using judgment. And nobody's going to have to learn that skill anymore, which is going to impact the way people think. So in 20 years, employees are not going to have the same judgment as they've got now. And I remember being really concerned about that. And then I was like, oh, actually, no, what's going to happen is AI is going to be the examiner. And you're going to have to argue and debate with AI and be able to articulate it and be like, oh, no, like, what about this? And, and be even smarter and even better judgment and even better at analyzing arguments. And so, you know, are there potential downsides? Yes, I'm sure there are, absolutely huge. But I also think that there will constantly be this evolution of a solution. Like, this is going to be, you know, it was when we got the internet, everybody's plagiarizing everything. Well, no, like, there's a way to kind of, get over it. So I'm more optimistic than I am pessimistic about AI. And, you know, I'm not focusing on the challenges. I think there will be, you know, regulation and policy change. And I hope that that can change as quickly as it needs to. Because often policies sort of lag technological advancements.
Yeah, I know that earlier on, I haven't heard of as much of it now, there was concern about bias actually, you know, expanding because of the way the algorithms are written versus being removed. But I really like your examiner kind of analogy there too, because it would be, with the speed of the technology, it would actually not be that much of a reach to say, let's get in and scan all of the performance appraisal documentation and see how consistent this person's judgment is over their team, regardless of their identity or gender or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it when you're thinking about things like that, again, is the data that you're putting in, right? If you're if you're putting in biased data, you're going to get biased output, absolutely. And so, you know, that. And some of that stuff, again, is about to scale, right? Not many, like, how many performance appraisals does one manager actually do? Well, they've probably on average got a span of, what, six people. And so you end, so on an individual level, you can probably already identify that, right?
Yeah.
You know, if I've got a team of six people and I've got five white men and one black woman, and I'm constantly rating the black woman terribly, even though everybody else thinks that she's incredible, there's something wrong, right? And you know, the unfortunate thing is that I don't think bias plays out very, I mean, it does in some cases, unfortunately, but bias is often a lot more subtler than that, right? And so finding data, like finding it in the data, is actually really, really difficult.
Yeah, I would imagine. Although, like you say, with the larger data set, maybe even across organizations, you'll start to see certain things. Like if you looked at managers of mid-career finance professionals, and you could say, hey, like the if on the bell curve, this is what's typical, and yet we've identified these managers in your organization that are either accelerating performance and pay and other things maybe above and beyond, or they're too hard on the team. We might start to see like what's normal or yeah. what's expected, and that's not going to prescribe how you should run every team, but it may actually just give you some guardrails to just check in and say, where should we be digging a little bit deeper in conversation?
Yeah, where is the norm in our organization and who's deviating from
yeah.
it?
Yeah. I always thought LinkedIn was going to go down that route when Microsoft bought them. I thought, and they've got so much data now, they can tell us, you know, hey, Bex, there's three people on your team that based on their cohort that they graduated with, they're likely to be moving in the next 6 months. Have you checked in with them? Like, I haven't seen that yet from LinkedIn or actually any other tool.
Yeah, no, but maybe we'll get there.
Maybe, yeah. I'd pay for that. And then as you think about you've worked in some cool industries, some cool brands as a leader in HR and people functions. As you think about the evolution of this function, what kind of new roles do you see showing up, whether it's reporting into the CHRO or CPO or, you know, adjacent to, as organizations really keep lifting that culture of thriving people and effective teams?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting how all teams will kind of evolve. I was just talking to someone who came back from a HR conference, and they said that there was this notion of like a chief AI officer will be a thing in organizations. I was like, I think, you know, I'm not sure if I buy that. I think that AI will just be so ingrained in what we do, it will be everywhere.
Yeah.
I think within our own teams, you know, the kind of head of employee happiness, right? Like mm-hmm. I think that I've talked a lot about employee happiness, and I think that we need to think and leverage the science of happiness a lot more.
Yeah.
And really focus on that. And again, it's not because, you know, happiness is this sort of twee phrase, if you like, right? And some people really don't like it. And I'm not saying it because I think everybody needs to be really happy. But actually, when you look at the science of happiness, every marker of success is increased if people are happy.
Yeah.
Doctors make better diagnosis when they're happy. They make them quicker and more accurately. Salespeople sell more. People take fewer sick days if they self-report that they're happy. They are more likely to be promoted, more likely to be paid more. And so it's both good for the individuals and for the organization. And
yeah.
So having, you know, people teams that are thinking, what do I need to do in order to really foster employee happiness? And how do I ingrain that into the employee value proposition? I think is going to be really critical, because a lot of the, you know, the more tactical work is going to be done by AI.
Yes.
Right? Like if you want to understand your benefits, then you simply ask somebody in the AI, like you just ask the AI and they'll be able to find the information, as opposed to right now it's on a benefits site and I need to, you know, send an email into HR operations to understand it. So, you know, things like that, I think will free up people's capacity to kind of focus on the stuff that is more uniquely human.
Yeah, I really, really value that. I saw MetLife appointed their first chief employee care officer, which is a cool title.
I didn't see that. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really cool. And it's interesting you raise happiness, and you touched on the fact that some people don't like happiness as a measure, because it's hard. It's hard to understand what's driving happiness. Is it something in work, out of work, chemistry? I don't know. But Adam Grant, I love his work-life podcast. He had Daniel Kahneman, the economist, on shortly before he passed away. And they did a great episode. I'll have Alicia add it to this show notes. But Kahneman said happiness isn't the measure. He said the measure is reducing misery, which is almost like the negative of happiness, right? But it was very cool, because anyone... It's hard to go through an organization and do a happiness audit. What's creating happiness in your team? But it's easy, you know, for you, Bex, or for any of us to go into our teams and say, what's causing misery right now? And how can we remove that misery for you?
Yeah. And I think the challenge with happiness as well, there is, I think especially in the US, there's been a pressure to kind of like, everybody's got to be really happy. Like, you should be happy all the time. And I don't believe that. So it's not possible. That's not why as humans, and again, what makes us uniquely human is the spectrum of emotions that we can feel, right? And we can feel multiple emotions at once. And that is wonderful. And we should honor each of the feelings that we feel. And if I don't feel particularly jolly and happy one day, I don't need to also feel bad about not feeling happy because I'm already feeling bad about what I'm feeling
Great
bad
point.
About.
Right? Yeah.
And so there, you know, I don't want people to think, and I certainly don't want employees. And so maybe I like this notion of a head of care or head of employee care rather than happiness. I wouldn't want our employees to think, God, you know, I have to feel happy all the time. Like, no, you don't. But part of the role of the people team is reducing that misery.
Yeah.
And, you know, enhancing ways and taking away some of the pain and showing care and compassion. And, you know, I want all employers to be caring and compassionate about their employees.
Yeah, I think that's huge. And particularly in today's era where employees have never faced more like on all day anxiety and stress with, you know, devices and everything else, that the amount of time we spend at work, it's not that employers are responsible wholesale. It's not that employees are just outsourcing their health and well-being, but we've got a big role to play.
Huge role to play. You extrapolate that out and you just think, okay, the impact of every employer on communities, on individuals, but then on communities, and then on countries and GDPs and things like that. Like, it's not just the the business success that has an impact on making the world or the country successful. It's actually also the psyche of the employees. And so I kind of think that it is a huge responsibility that I don't know that every employer takes as seriously. It's almost, well, I'm kind of being forced to do this because employees expect me to, rather than seeing that there is a bigger purpose to that. And it's part of our social responsibility.
Yeah, there's a total correlation there between healthy customers, vendors, employees, you name it. That's neat. So maybe there is also a chief misery reduction officer out there.
that would be cool. I'd like that job title.
You kind of feel like a strange kind of Santa Claus. Instead of dropping gifts off, you're taking things away, which is a gift in itself. Well, there's been a lot of great ground that we've covered. I like the way that you explained employee thriving, and particularly its linkage to sort of intentional culture and being honest about culture. And then sort of diving into the sort of flow elements, you know, how you work. And the ski analogy, clearly one of my favorite parts, because it I connect with it. And I think the way that you gave me that advice on like bringing the team together to set out our objectives, what are we optimizing for at the beginning, but then maybe checking in the middle, that was a really cool sort of commentary and advice there. And then naturally we touched on the continuous performance management and AI and nudging. There's so many great takeaways from this discussion, Bex. I really appreciate you taking the time to share it with us.
No, it was an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
You bet. If anyone wants to find you or your content, I know you do a lot of speaking and other podcasts. How do they best connect with you?
It's probably through LinkedIn. So you can find me on LinkedIn, although it is Rebecca Port on LinkedIn. So that's probably the easiest way.
Great. Well, we'll make sure to connect your profile there in the show notes too. Great. Well, thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Remember that by embracing vulnerability, trusting our intuition, and approaching challenges with compassion, we not only strengthen our teams, but also pave the way for a future where collaboration thrives. If you're hungry for more insights, strategies, and research on collaboration, head over to thefutureofteamwork.com. There, you can join our mailing list to stay updated with the latest episodes and get access to exclusive content tailored to make your team thrive. Together, we can build the future of teamwork. Until next time.